Welcome to Plastics Unwrapped, a series supported by Dow, the materials science company. I'm your host, Maitri Sitharaman. In this podcast, we're on the hunt for solutions to some of the toughest challenges facing the plastics industry. I'll be joined by my producer, Lisa Desai.
Hey, everyone.
She's the woman with all the facts and figures we're going to be talking about. We're going to try and have some seriously honest conversations with guests from across sectors and from across the world. So let's together figure out what it'll really take to save the future of our planet.
It doesn't matter if you have data, if people don't believe it, and if you don't collect information in a consistent, reliable, robust, and repeatable way.
Conversations about artificial intelligence, whether it's in the policy space or its business use, they've become so predictable, Lisa, they're boring.
But it isn't for the scientists.
I know. They say that it makes the research of their dreams possible, but it's really honestly a double-edged sword, isn't it? The data it generates might be the ticket to us tackling the climate crisis, but it's incredibly energy intensive.
It's also water intensive. So we've talked about water stewardship on this show. And if you think about it, one medium-sized data center uses as much water as three average-sized hospitals.
But then again, those scientists, Lisa, will tell us that AI can measure changes in, say, for example, icebergs 10,000 times faster than a human can. So it's a good thing.
There are good things. It's also being used to predict where and when climate disasters will occur. And there's even a company in California that's using AI to help companies track and trace and reduce their carbon emissions by 20 to 30%.
So today, let's sift fact from fiction and look at AI's potential in tackling plastic waste. Our next guest, well, she's been talking trash for about 15 years at Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. That name is long. Short form, CSIRO. She is the senior principal research scientist there. Denise Hardestay and her team estimate about 14 million tons of microplastics are chilling at the bottom of the ocean. And she's using AI to get the full scoop on how it ends up there. And that research is a game changer. Denise, it's so great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you guys at CSIRO have a pretty lofty target for plastic waste reduction in Australia. You've said 80% reduction by 2030, but you're also operating across the world. I mean, you're working with so many different countries. I mean, from Hobart all the way to Bangladesh to here in London, where I'm sitting. A lot of your work seems to come down to the technology that you're using. Run us through how AI, technology, robotics are influencing the research that you do.
Sure. So I think in the work that we're doing, we do a lot of really simple human-based work. And then we're also increasingly using smart technology that can help us with data collection at scale. And so one of the key things that we're doing is actually using these quite inexpensive field cameras, wildlife cameras that are waterproof that we can put out under bridges or near waterways so that we can start to take imagery, video, and photographs, et cetera, of floating debris. Now, one of the things then that you need to do, of course, is to identify what is that trash that's floating down the river? And that's where AI or, you know, ML comes into play. And so we've been developing machine learning algorithms that allow us to not just say it's trash or not trash, which is where many of the efforts have gotten to date, because it's actually really difficult to identify floating debris, right? It's easy to say, is that a cat? Is that a boat? Is that a human? Is that a traffic light? It's much more difficult to say, is that crumpled object? Is it a water bottle? Is it a metal can? Is it a crumpled up, you know, container of some other sort? And so training the models means you need to have a lot of data. You need to have a lot of floating debris to use to identify the different categories of debris that we want to identify. So one of the things that we're doing is putting out these cameras, running them for weeks at a time, capturing the imagery and videos from that, coming back, running the machine learning algorithms over the data. So then we're able to identify and categorize different objects. And then what we're doing with that is able to say, these are hot spots where we're finding much more debris in this river or in this waterway. Or we can say, hey, these are the particularly problematic items that we're finding in our waterways. What are then some of the potential legislation levers or policy approaches or outreach campaigns that are maybe likely to be effective in this geopolitical area, in this country, in this community, to resonate with people and to say, hey, we don't want this trash floating down our waterways. Let's do something about it.
You've got some projects going on. Just run me through how that works with what you just explained. Say, for example, in Hobart, what are you doing in Hobart to change up how much plastic waste is going into the ocean?
One of the things that we're doing in a couple of cities around Australia, so we've just been working near Sydney, we've done some work in Hobart, and then we're getting ready to start some trials in other cities around the country, is to go out, put out these cameras in different areas along the waterways so that we can make comparisons. Is there more trash here than there? Is there a lot of litter overall, or is there not very much? And I think one of the things that's really tricky in doing this in a country such as Australia is that, frankly, we're pretty clean overall. And so that means that you have lots of frames that don't have trash in them. Now, that's great for our communities. It does make it harder to train the models. And so one of the other things that we're doing right now is partnering with universities in Indonesia, where they are putting out these same cameras, running them in the same time frames, et cetera, so that we can start to see what are some of the similarities and differences in different parts of the world. And, you know, we have seen and we understand from some initial trials that we've done that in the area that we're putting cameras out in Indonesia, there's quite a bit more floating debris than there is along our, in our waterways in Hobart, or than there is in and around Sydney Harbour.
Does that play a role when the human element comes in to train these AI models?
As part of that project in Indonesia, that's exactly what we're doing. We're talking with community members, we're working with government, we're working with university researchers to collectively and collaboratively understand what are the problems, what are the pinch points, and where can we enact that change. So it's really a great nexus of bringing together people and technology for the people that are invested in the community so that they also have some of that ownership connection to what's going on in their environment. And then they can actually be part of the change and they can help lead and structure that change. And to me, it's really important to have not just community initiated measures, but to have that real collaboration. And so while it may not be something the community started, making sure that we work, you know, hand in glove with the community, I think is really important for the success of the project.
How much importance do you put on the data that you're collecting in helping them and other countries improve waste management so it never gets into the rivers in the first place? We're talking about plastic waste, of course.
So what importance do I put on the data? I am a scientist. I am a science geek. So I put supreme importance on the data. But it doesn't matter if you have data, if people don't believe it, and if you don't collect information in a consistent, reliable, robust, and repeatable way. And so one of the things that's critical is that we're working across all these countries within the region. We're actually working with the United Nations. We're working with these member countries that are choosing to participate. And we are able to offer them something that's, frankly, it's low cost, it's quick, you know, it's relatively inexpensive, et cetera. And by collecting data in a similar way across these countries, we can actually start to make comparisons in ways that people can trust. And really, some of the impetus behind this is that countries want to know, is it true? There was a paper that came out in 2015 that talked about the top 20 polluting countries in terms of plastic waste entering the global ocean from these countries. But it was based upon model estimates without anybody going out there and actually measuring, counting. And so there's not a lot of confidence in some of that from countries, understandably, in my view. You know, they want to know, is it really true that, you know, the Philippines is number X or Indonesia is number Y in terms of this country pollutants entering the environment. So what we're really trying to do is to support countries to be able to enact socially, economically, environmentally appropriate place-based solutions. And they need the knowledge from the data to do that. And so if we go out and measure and monitor in a similar way across these countries, build the capacity in countries that are requesting this. It's not that we want to go in and interject our approach anywhere. We want to be invited in by countries who are deciding, hey, this is cheap, it's quick, it's effective, it's robust, it's reliable. We can do this in multiple places around the country if we want. That sounds good. And that will allow us to measure and to monitor, to establish a national baseline. We can then measure change. We can identify what are the problematic items in our country or in this region, because they're not the same. Even across the Asia-Pacific region, for example, we find really different problematic items in Cambodia versus Philippines versus South Korea, for example. You know, not all places are the same. And we really want to support the countries to create the change that they identify with the tools and the techniques and the approaches that work for them.
How important do you think your work is in convincing plastic manufacturers, for example, to perhaps put their focus more on the recycled plastic? Do you think that that is more critical use of the data along with the legislation? Or do you think trust in your research will help change consumer behavior that will drive it? Which one comes first for you, influencing the producers or the consumers?
Boy, I would like to see all of that happening together. I think one of the real challenges is that we have increasingly seen a push to the consumers. Oh, it's about consumer behavior and changing individual behavior. Individuals are super powerful, and we are seeing a change in behavior. At the same time, we equally need to see legislation and a push and a drive from the plastic producers and manufacturers. You know, my experience in this field for the last well over 15 years does not suggest that plastic production is heading towards a decrease, right? We all know that global plastic production is increasing, which is driven by, I would say, in my experience, it's driven more by production or price cost than it is around the concern over contamination in recycled plastics, because we know that there are really reasonable ways that we can ensure food grade safe plastic that is not virgin plastic, but that virgin plastic costs are much lower than it is for recycled plastic content. We are also seeing a push in the market from consumers requesting or requiring an increase in recycled plastic content. And that's where individuals, consumers, essentially can be quite powerful. I think we need to see the push and the pull coming from both. And I think the third pillar of that, I suppose, if you will, is going to be legislation. You know, and that brings us to, is there going to be a legally binding global plastics treaty, you know, which touches on all the parts of the life cycle. And that's what we're hearing. That's what we're seeing. It's different in different countries. If you know, from some of the high ambition coalition countries versus the not as high ambition countries. And there's a lot of push within the global plastics conversations, within the global treaty conversations about some of these matters, you know. So where do I want to see the data? I want to see the data perhaps inspire change from the manufacturers and empower consumers to push based upon their belief system. At the same time, I think it is foolish, to be honest, to think that you go into a country where you don't have clean and safe drinking water and tell people you should not have single-use plastic water bottles. You know, like when you hear that so often from countries where we do have those privileges. And so, you know, this plastic pollution issue, it disproportionately affects women. It disproportionately affects low socioeconomic status countries and actually communities. Like our data shows, perhaps not a shock, we find more litter, we find more trash, we find more rubbish, more waste in lower socioeconomic areas where people are economically disadvantaged, where they have lower education, where they do not have the infrastructure and resources that come with supporting people to do the right thing. Because our research has also shown that where you have bins, where you have infrastructure, where you make it easy for people, people want to do the right thing. We also need to have the support and the services and the resources to enable that for them, in my view.
Some of that data, and I want to come back to your science in itself, you've just cracked the code in some ways of getting us data of more than just pictures of birds and turtles trapped with plastic. You've gone to the seabed and come up with data thanks to robotics and machine learning to give us a real snapshot and a reality check of what our consumer behavior, what our current geopolitical environment and our economic is doing to the bed of the ocean. Run us through why that is so important and what that research report really came up with.
So we estimate that there's somewhere between 3 and 11 million metric tons of plastic pollution on the ocean floor. And that was as of just a few years ago. And so that is between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude. So between 10 and 100 times more than what scientists have predicted is floating on the ocean surface. And I really believe that by understanding what and where and how much debris there is in these different reservoirs, as they call them, or, you know, areas of our planet, we can really start to create change. And hopefully that will resonate with people. They'll feel empowered, have their voices heard about what's important to them. And they'll really consider what that means for the fate of the planet and for the fate of us as a global community and exactly what kind of world we really want to be living in.
So Denise, tell me, where do you put more importance in the data collection for AI where it is currently? Because I'm guessing you also believe that AI is just starting to get smarter and smarter. And it's going to be a whole different picture when we're talking about 12 months. Mm. Where do you put the importance of the focus of this data collection? At the storm drain level or at the drain level in cities and towns and villages or in the ocean or at the mouth of the river that's opening into the ocean? Where should countries be focusing if they're not partnering with you and they have to do it, go on their own?
Well, I guess I would like to see everybody focusing as far upstream as possible. And so to me, we don't want to be focusing on it in the ocean. You know, as far upstream upriver as possible is even better. And before that, you know, I think there's a real opportunity to use AI to make predictions, not only about like where we're going to find debris, but that we can use it to do some hotspot mapping and take approaches that allow us to better understand where and when we may want to deploy different types of infrastructure or rubbish bins or, you know, signage or any of those things that really do help change people's behavior. So I am an incredibly pragmatic, practical person, and I want to know what's my end game. I'm not interested in the novel application for novel application's sake as much as I am interested in figuring out, like, what am I going to do with this information? How am I going to use this tool? So, you know, another amazing approach that I'm seeing great opportunity for with AI is around analyzing huge data sets from social media, from journalism articles, et cetera, to see what's the trend, what's changing in the public, what's changing with industry, what's changing with government. Let's run the algorithms over some of those different types of data sources that are huge and that there's no way we as individuals could go through and process. And let's use some of that novel application of this huge growth in technology and processing so that we can apply, you know, understanding changes in government, changes in industry, changing in human behavior, and where and how is that different? I think that is a super rich place to explore for AI and ML that I am really excited by, and how we can apply that knowledge, that information, those huge data sets to really create change and to help, I would say, nudge behavior.
I love someone who says they want to see impact in their work, and I love it when I hear it. So the question then is, so many people doing so much work and so much data collection around the world, what's your dream in bringing all of those data sets together to actually be useful in impact? We've got, you know, CERN doing work in the oceans. We've got so many other organizations in North America, Africa, Asia doing all of this work. But all of these are, you know, in isolation or for their regions. What's your dream? How do we bring it all together?
Well, you'd have to get lots of people and lots of governments and lots of institutions to agree. And we know how difficult or tricky or challenging that is. And that has difficulties in different countries, which have different cultures and practices around it, for one thing. But, you know, what would be my dream? My dream would be to be out of a job, because there would not be so much waste out there in the environment that I need to keep measuring and monitoring and try to come up with technologies and approaches and work with people that are far smarter than me to help create change in the world. So I would love, my dream would be for that problem to be solved. Alas, I do not think that is likely, right? You know, humans have amazing capacity to create and to develop new things. And we also have amazing capacity for destruction and for self-destruction. So I suppose, you know, one of my dreams or hope would be to see this global plastics treaty really have some teeth. I'd like to see, and I am ever an optimist, I suppose I'd really love to see countries and governments take a holistic, whole of planet, generous approach. And by generous, I don't mean we need to just keep extracting more fossil fuel. By generous, I mean thinking about what can we do without? How can we do better? So I would love to see us making decisions with a legacy mindset. So maybe that would be my goal or my dream, to have us make decisions about the products that we make, the things that we produce, the houses that we live in, the materials that we, you know, use for the vehicles that we drive in, all those things, and thinking about designing with a legacy mindset.
And hopefully all your work with machine learning and robotics and being as confident as you are that you can reach your very, very lofty goals at CSIRO. 80% reduction, folks, in plastic waste by 2030. That's what they're aiming for. Denise, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Heading over to Europe, Mark Ruswim at the Wageningen University is also using it to tackle ocean plastic waste, but this time from a whole different angle that even Elon Musk would approve of. Mark, welcome to the show. We're so delighted to have you join us. Give us a little bit of a background on how you get involved with marine debris, bringing in AI. It's also new.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. My background is in earth science, so I studied geodesy and remote sensing. So I come a lot from the satellite and aerial image processing side. And I worked a bit during my PhD on agricultural applications, like classifying fields in Europe, where we have a lot of data, both on the satellite and also on the ground side. And then towards the end of my PhD, I teamed up with colleagues from European Space Agency, and we started working on environmentally interesting problems like marine litter. It was a side project for a while during my PhD and then my early postdoc. And now as an assistant professor in Wageningen, I can really focus on the marine litter topic from a machine learning, artificial intelligence direction. Basically, how can we process image data at a large scale effectively, because we are pretty much beyond the scope where one can manually sift through all the data that satellites produce, and how can we actually adapt those models for this problem specifically.
So Mark, lay out the problem you are trying to solve for.
We are working on detection of marine litter at a large scale, and for that we have access to satellite data at a reasonable resolution of about 3 to 10 meter, but importantly we have it at daily or weekly resolutions. So we have data basically every 3 to 5 days. And that really allows us to cover a large area fairly frequently. but because it's satellite data, we can't really see individual objects, but we see agglomerations of floating matter that is often from natural origins, but it can also contain plastics in specific areas where the pollution levels are high.
So how does AI fit into all the work that you're doing if you're using satellites and the data? How does AI kind of bridge that?
It allows us to really process data at a large scale. So classically, for visual photo interpretation, one would manually have to sift through, visually look at the images, and that's not feasible at that scale. So what we can do is we annotate or label data, a few hundred or thousand examples, and then train a deep neural network, an artificial intelligence model, to basically approximate this manual annotation. And that can then be run automatically on new data at a large scale.
So if you're saying that there's lots of marine debris and everything is all mixed up and there's some plastic in there, but there's lots of other stuff in there, how does the AI really track the plastic bit? And how big a piece can it track? Can it go like from massive pieces of fishing net all the way down to microplastics?
So there's two things. So there's larger pieces of like 3 to 4 meters in size, but also mainly there's agglomerations of floating matter in general. And those happen fairly frequently because there is processes like windrows or dynamic fronts where surface water flows together and then sinks, and everything that is floating on the surface accumulates to large rows, and those are very visible on these satellite images. And those we can detect. And then is the question how to differentiate natural objects with plastic and other little objects. And there we have data beyond the visible spectrum. So usually we can only see red, green, and blue, but those satellites, they capture near-infrared, shortwave infrared data, and that's actually quite important and relevant to distinguish different types of plastics from other materials like wood, for instance. So that's here we can see actually more than the human eye could see.
What are the issues you're facing at this point in developing the tech, not just from the tech side, but also from just the pure flow of information and data, because data is everywhere?
Annotated data is the target that we would like to predict with a model. So typically, we need to sit down and visually click on the objects in an image that we are interested in, and then basically train a deep neural network to predict these objects given the images. So that's basically how deep learning and artificial intelligence work. And those are really difficult to get by because we have hardly any ground annotations from satellite images where those objects are. So we naturally work in a space with limited annotated data, where we need to come up with like smart ways to train those models. We need to pre-train these models first on the data that we have and then fine-tune them with domain expertise of human experts.
So how do you train an AI when the data collection in itself is so disparate? I mean, are there examples of how it can be done and should be done?
So the fallback that we have in other countries outside of Europe is like the visual photo interpretation. So we look at the images, we see floating matter on the surface, and then we can annotate that data. So when in countries with a high level of pollution, we can see quite large patches and objects floating, and those we can annotate. And then we can deduct based on the environment and some local image data what these agglomerations most likely contain. So there is, for instance, a flood in Durban in South Africa that caused a lot of plastics to wash out into the harbor and then into the open oceans.
How do you convince varied governments to share what could be sensitive data? And how do you fund your program so that you don't have any question marks that the AI is biased or not biased?
So what helps here is that we are working on environmental issues that basically... there is an incentive across multiple governments to support research in that direction. And in terms of data, it all hinges on the willingness of countries to be open with this problem, to collect data and share it publicly. So that leads to a bit of a difficult situation because there are some countries that are very open to share their data. to basically make that problem very visible. But then, of course, they are also on the spotlight because we can quantify that, for instance, in Ghana, that there is a big litter problem. But the same problem is also present in other countries that are not as openly sharing the data. And that's where policy comes in. And actually, how can we implement sustainable development goal indicators to inform the UN on the global state of plastic litter? So Ghana is a really good example here because they are very aware of this problem and they collect data through citizen science and provide that data in a UN standardized format as a social development goal indicator. Then that's what we kind of need to work towards to make this data more available overall.
So how do you make sure that everyone believes the data that you're collecting? Because there's always a question mark about bias or good data, bad data, good research, who's funding the research, everyone has an agenda. How do you keep the trust?
The key point here is to work with open data. And we are working in this environmental space with public satellite data. And whenever we do research that is publicly funded, we also provide the data that is collected and the models that are trained publicly to the people. So in that sense, companies can take the models and can take the data to train their own models. And everybody can basically visually verify what is in those objects. It gets more difficult on satellite data because we don't visually see clearly what is there. But when we look at aerial data and UAV data, it's pretty clear that if there is a plastic straw or some objects present, you cannot really doubt this. It's more rather a factor of scalability here.
I mean, we talk about tech for good. So, Mark, why should it matter that you want to scale this to people? Why is it good for the planet? Is it good for the planet?
The data and the AI, they provide information primarily, and that information can inform policy, and it should inform policy. So, at the moment, I feel we are flying blind in some ways. For instance, in Europe, we have the plastic straw policy, where plastic straws are banned in some countries. But other countries try to change the policies to make plastic straws reusable. And this technology can be used to really quantify the effect of this policy on the ground. So, for instance, when we see that on the beach litter in the Netherlands, we don't see plastic straws anymore in the future, we see that this policy was effective. And that gives us support to continue going in that direction. But when we see, for instance, in other countries like in Greece, when they change the policy slightly to make thicker plastic straws reusable, even though they are not used in a reusable way, we should be able to continue seeing plastic straws being disposed in the marine environment. And then that is a clear indicator that this policy is not implemented effectively in some countries than in others, and then they can be adjusted. So data and artificial intelligence provides information to really understand our environment and then really guide our decisions without necessarily guessing the direction. So that's why this is an important topic, and that's why we are doing research in this direction.
Mark, on that note, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk about these topics.
Next time on Plastics Unwrapped, AI is just the beginning. We're diving into the tech of the future, or is it already here and we haven't woken up to it yet? Buckle up, because we're going to take a wild and perhaps scary ride into the future with futurist and walking encyclopedia of all things next gen, Matthew Griffin. Thanks for sticking with us to the end as we hunt for solutions to make plastics truly circular. This podcast is supported by Dow, one of the world's leading materials science companies. And don't forget to share the show if you enjoyed it. Do leave us a comment or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.